Asian Americans are the fastest growing minority group in the U.S. We talk with Asian Americans Advancing Justice Executive Director Tuet Lay about how activism has changed over the years.
The race dynamics have been so black and white, literally, that Asian Americans enter it in a different place, recognizing both the disadvantages as well as the privilege that we have in this racial dynamic.
Plus, in honor of National Poetry Month, we speak with Illinois poets from across the state about how living in Illinois shapes their work. And for those of you who find poetry intimidating, here's some advice from poet David Wright of Monmouth College in Western Illinois.
We binge watch television. We watch 300 episodes of the same series. Try binge reading some poems and see which one appeals to you. There's no requirement. Enjoy it. Let it have its own pleasures.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Asian Americans have lived in Chicago for more than 100 years, and after the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965, the number of Asian Americans living in the U.S. dramatically increased. And by 1990, there were more than 290,000 Asian Americans in Illinois. This past year, the first Asian American was actually elected to the state house. That's Teresa Ma. We wanted today to talk about a group of activists who founded an organization called Asian Americans Advancing Justice. It's an advocacy group in Chicago that's celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. Joining me on the line is Tuet Lay. She's executive director of AAAJ. Tuet, welcome to the 21st. Thank you so much for being here with me.
Thank you for having me.
I wonder what's unique about the history of Asian American activism, particularly in Chicago and Illinois, because I think when people think about the history of organizing in the Asian American community, inevitably everybody sort of looks to the West Coast or they look to large population centers like New York City. What is the history of what Asian American activism has been in Chicago?
I think there has been a lot more of it recently. Right.
And
what's interesting, at least at this point in history, is that there are a lot of ethnic organizations and people working together. There aren't specific groups that are large enough to sort of break off and do their own advocacy. As much as we are the fastest growing population, we're still relatively small compared to the rest of Illinois' population. We're about 5 or 6%. And so we still see that being together across different ethnic groups is really important. And I think it has also evolved over the last few years about working across racial lines, right? Around immigration, probably for the last decade or more, that, you know, we're more intentionally working with Latinx communities. And I think with some of the police accountability work that has come up through the Black Lives Matter movement, there are a lot of Asian Americans who are seeing the work more intersectionally as well.
That's a really interesting generational difference I want to talk to you about in a minute. I think a lot of people may not be aware that when you look at youth involvement, millennial involvement in the Black Lives Matter movement, after African-American millennials, Asian Americans are the number two biggest group involved in Black Lives Matter from what I've seen of other groups of color. So I do want to talk to you about that in a second, but I want to ask you about, you mentioned police accountability, and I know that you and a group of other activists recently went to O'Hare in protest to what happened with United Airlines. Of course, the case everybody's so familiar with at this point, unfortunately, the Vietnamese doctor David Dao violently dragged off a flight to make room for four crew members. Why was it important for Asian Americans Advancing Justice to go to O'Hare and say, hey, this isn't okay? I have to say, this is something that maybe we haven't. I know you said people have been more involved recently. I wonder if 15 years ago that this would have happened. You would have had a group protesting at the airport, Asian Americans.
Yeah, I don't think 15 years ago it would have happened. I've been at my organization for over 17 years now, and I can tell you just in terms of capacity as well as understanding of this type of issue, seeing the nuances of it, it's definitely evolved, right? And, I think for us, there's a number of factors that went into why we wanted to do this. One was just that we still want to challenge the idea that Asian Americans will remain quiet when something horrific happens or any, you know, slights happen against Asian Americans, and to really highlight how we see this as, you know, this escalated violence against everyday people by the police, right? These are just these strong arm tactics for something that should have never escalated to that level. And it, we see this not, so we've seen this with Asian American communities on video, right, for this case and a previous case we worked on. We also see this in other communities, right, in Black communities, Latinx communities, and since we've been doing this work in solidarity, right, we wanted to give voice to this as well as, you know, have our allies demonstrate the solidarity. And it's very complicated, I think, in the Asian American community, right, where, you know, the race dynamics have been so Black and white, literally, that, you know, Asian Americans enter it in a different place, recognizing both the disadvantages as well as the privilege that we have in this racial dynamic.
There is more of a voice now of Asian Americans saying, first of all, the identity itself, you know, that we are Asian American, and that's a whole other thing I want to talk to you about in a second. But I just wonder how you would describe this moment nationally as well as in Chicago, of understanding what Asian American activism is.
You know, I think that definitely millennials play a big part in this understanding, right? They, you know, I don't think anyone would describe us in a post-racial world in terms of racism being eradicated. But the ways that identity is understood, not just around race, but around gender, is a lot more nuanced than what it was when I was growing up, for example. And so this conversation just looks really differently in terms of, I think, younger folks in particular understanding that they want to lead with their Asian American identity, but that it's much more expansive and, you know, they tend to be more progressive in that they want to bring a lot more people along, right?
Mm-hmm.
Both in terms of building power, we're still relatively small, and I think they see building power, a key part of that is finding alliances, right? And so the places they find alliances has been other marginalized communities, right? And so it's for, you know, their own interests to build this, but it's also how they feel the world should be moving.
When we think about the term Asian American, I think it's worth just talking about that for a minute, because it is such a construct that I think really also only exists in North America. It's such a wide range of communities, you know, whether we're talking about Vietnam, whether we're talking about India, whether they're talking about even someone like me, right? My family's from the Indian diaspora. So my family is 5 generations removed from India, but I'm Asian American, you know, in this country. Mm-hmm. I'm in the same group as you, right? So I wonder, when we think about that construct, do you think that for a younger as we talk about so much the younger generation, do you think that even that notion of Asian American, all of this sort of, it's so much more in pop culture, whether we're thinking about comedians like Ali Wong or, you know, other comedians like Aziz Ansari, or do you think that the fact that there's so much more of a vocal pop culture voice of Asian American, that makes it an easier identity also for people to understand?
You know, it is a construct, and I think what's interesting is that it started as something that was a political identity, right? That was pulling different ethnic Asian ethnic groups together under this progressive political identity that aligned itself with the civil rights movement, right? And I think that that's, but, you know, with the opening up of immigration because of the civil rights movement, that identity became more almost cultural, right, and census-like. So it's just sort of like, this is the category we put you in, whether you identify with that political identity or not. I think what you see with young people who have a progressive idea adopting that as the way they understand, you know, their politics, right, and what they can do with power. I think that fluidity of being able to say that somebody from whose parents are from India is like a person who is a Vietnamese refugee like myself. It's this idea of like, do we have a shared fate, right? As a largely immigrant community that has a history of being barred, you know, or a history of the way we travel here, a history of the perceptions of who we are, how well educated we are, what kinds of problems we do or do not have. I think there is an affinity that way that's different than, you know, that can be understood outside of just, do we understand each other's language and culture and food?
Well, and I think, you know, you mentioned immigration, you know, and I think it's always worth pointing out that originally, you know, most of the most restrictive immigration laws in this country historically were formed specifically for excluding Asian, you know, people coming from Asia. How important is for an organization like Asian Americans Advancing Justice? Is that sort of, what would you say are the biggest issues that you all advocate for now? Is it still immigration?
Yeah, I think it is still, immigration is a huge part of our advocacy work, and tied to that is language access. Once people are here, some more immigrant integration. And I think it's still very important. 2/3 of the Asian American community is foreign-born. You know, the ways that people come over is largely through immigration. That's how we have become the fastest growing population. So we recognize the history of how Asian Americans have been allowed in, and what types of Asian Americans Asians have been allowed in, right? I mean, this is partly why there's this model minority myth, you know, because a lot of Asian Americans have been able to come in accessing different types of work visas only if they have certain types of education, as well as, you know, jobs, right? So I think, but we still believe that the U.S. immigration system should be based on families, right? That's obviously a huge part of many Asian cultures. And so, you know, as much as you have a degree, and a job, you still want to be able to bring your family over. And I think that's the aspect that we fight for as well.
I'm talking with Tuet Lay. She's the executive director of Asian Americans Advancing Justice. This year they celebrate their 25th anniversary. Tuet, as you look back over the organization, obviously you haven't been involved for those past 25 years, but you have been involved pretty intimately for the past, you know, 15 years or so. What, as you look back on the history of what you all have been advocating for and what's important now, how have things changed?
I think the issues are a little bit more nuanced, and we've been able to go a lot deeper. I think because, you know, our capacity has expanded. When I started, I was like the sole staff person. But I think that immigration is still primary. I think issues of representation in government in particular have also been at the top of our list. I actually think that the thing that has changed is probably the way we as an organization think about representation. It had previously been, you know, you want an Asian American in places of power, right? We have a different take on it. We think that having an Asian American is really important, but it also has to come with an understanding of what those community issues are, as well as a willingness to push for them, right? I mean, we don't want an Asian American who doesn't understand our issues and is just there as a face to this, or is too hesitant to push for what the community's needs are. And so thankfully we have, you know, legislators now who come from the community, get the issues, are fighting for those issues. And I think that's a great thing.
When you think about the election of people like Teresa Ma from Chinatown, it might be remarkable to people that this is the first Asian American elected to the state house. in Springfield in the history of Illinois, and it happened in 2017 is when, or what happened in 2016. How much do you think the role of the community, how important was the role of the community in getting an election like that to happen?
Oh, I think it was absolutely enormous. The story that people may not know is it was really maybe a decades in the making, right? Because this is a story about redistricting and getting a good map for an Asian American. It was about census, right? It was about community organizing. It was about voter registration. I mean, those are things that the Chinatown community had been working on for years and years. It was something that Teresa, as a staff person, was working on. And, you know, I think I want to push the idea that that legislators had been thought of as these sort of heroes to save the community, when it's really the community who makes the heroes, right? And so it was just, I think it was a pretty amazing story. And I think, you know, one of the other things that was really helpful too is that some of the policies that we passed around having election day registration, right? There were about 500 people who used it, and her margin of victory was around that as well. And so I think there are all these different things at play that various people have been working on for a long time that made that possible. And, you know, to be clear, it was her opponent was somebody who was being anointed, right, by the Chicago machine, which is a very difficult thing to overcome. So I think there was a lot of amazing organizing work that was happening for her campaign specifically, but just a group of people who had been working very hard for a long time.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Tuet Lay. She's the Executive Director of Asian Americans Advancing Justice. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Tuet Lay. She's Executive Director of Asian Americans Advancing Justice. The Chicago-based nonpartisan advocacy group is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. We were just talking about the election of Teresa Ma, the first Asian American in the State House. And you were just saying, Tuet, before the break, that these were people who were able to, this election was something where she was able to overcome kind of the Chicago machine, which is pretty surprising even these days in 2017. You were talking about redistricting, and I wonder how much you think that, you know, the decades-long effort that went into that, how much of redistricting kind of plays a role in who gets elected, especially when we're talking about racial or ethnic identity from neighborhoods?
Yes, it plays a big role. I mean, the previous redistricting maps for the Chinatown area had it carved up into four different districts, right? And the new map has a good part of Chinatown in it. I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but it definitely was an important factor in the community's voice being heard. And I think that's the point, right? I think a lot of people think about redistricting as, oh, then you can have a candidate. But the idea is, you know, you can have a candidate of your choice, right? And someone who is listening to the community, someone who is fighting for the community. So I think, you know, and we're already thinking about census and redistricting coming up, right? It'll be, again, really important for Asian Americans and everyone to be involved in what that looks like. Because I think at the end of the day, it's really like, do you have enough influence to make your voice heard to whomever is, you know, representing you, whether they're Asian American, Black, Latino, anyone? I think that's the important part. And that's the pivot for us. You know, the work that we're doing is that we're holding everyone accountable. We're not waiting for one person to represent all of us. So we work with, you know, legislators across the state, right, to talk about issues, especially the ones that represent huge Asian American populations, right?
Right. And I think we tend to of this to be so much of a Chicago-focused conversation. How do you think the Asian American community in Chicago connects with other places throughout the state? Do we have a sense that from an activism role, places like, I'm thinking of Asian American students who were very active on campus here in Urbana at the University of Illinois. A lot of them come from the Chicago region. Do you have a sense that the communities across, obviously Chicago is the center, but do you have a sense that kind of the communities are connected wherever they are in Illinois?
I think it's harder for folks that are outside of the six county area. You know, I think it's about 80 or 90% of the state's Asian American population is in the six county area. So, you know, definitely, and I think Urbana, that's a little bit harder to connect with, but we do see growing activism out in the suburbs, and this is what we're actually trying to do more of with
activism in the Chicago suburbs. Interesting. And can I ask you one thing we started talking about at the beginning, sort of generational gaps? Mm-hmm. You know, do we see a generational gap between younger Asian American activists, and I'm thinking particularly here in Chicago or in Illinois, and maybe older generations?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd be fooling myself to say that there wasn't, but I do think that we're trying to create that space where everyone is working together. So we have a coalition that is probably more older leaders who are running social service agencies that serve different Asian or Asian ethnic groups, but, you know, their leadership varies, right? But it does tend to be older. I think a lot of our community leaders, our volunteers tend to be younger. And what we want to do is create a space where they're working on all of these things together. But I think that being said, every organization is dealing with that that dynamic, right? This intergenerational dynamic. I think, you know, when I was young, I dealt with it with the older folks in the organization that I was working in, right? There's always that. I think there's always that generation gap, you know, that exists. Which is compounded in a way, if you want to think about it, with like those who are American born. Versus those who, you know, grew up in their home countries, mm-hmm. right? But again, this is just gets repeated. I think it's just on a
That's
larger
a very common thing
scale
across all immigrant communities, isn't it?
Yeah.
Can you, so this is your 25th year for AAAJ. Yeah. You guys have lots of events that you have going on this year to celebrate.
Yeah, so we are going to have our benefit that's coming up. We're honoring Teresa and Raja
Ma.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And yes, Raja Krishnamurthy, right, who's also just elected to Congress from former Representative Tammy Duckworth's seat, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. And so, as well as Stephen Yeun from The Walking Dead. And so we're really excited about that event. And then we are working on other things. The theme for this year is celebrating creative resistance, right? So, you know, I think the resistance part is really important. It's the work that we've done for a long time. It seems to be the theme of, you know, this year in terms of not just us, but groups around the country in terms of how people are perceiving the landscape changing, us being, you know, not honoring diversity as much as we have, not valuing immigrants as much as we have, and we really want to resist that trend. But we also want to be creative because I think these are hard times, and I think you have to think about the world differently, how you move things when, you know, things seem to be topsy-turvy. And so we want to have that resistance. There's a digital campaign that we are working on. We'll have a concert in the fall with another Asian American artist who's honoring us by, you know, doing a concert for us. And so I think we're still trying to think of other things that we are working on, but we do want to mark this as something that is a longer campaign than just one event.
And what the next 25 years will look like, right, for Asian Americans advancing justice. Thank you so much for joining us and chatting with us a little bit about the past, present, and future Tuetlay is the executive director of Asian Americans Advancing Justice, a Chicago-based nonpartisan advocacy group. Tuet, thanks for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
April is National Poetry Month, and in honor of that, we thought we would assemble some Illinois poets to talk about their craft, how and why they write, and what our poetry scene looks like across the state. In studio with me in Urbana is Gail Renee Walden. She's a poet who's based in Urbana. She's taught at the University of Illinois and with the Education Justice Project at the Danville Correctional Facility. From Western Illinois, David Wright is on the line with us, where he teaches creative writing and American literature at Monmouth College. And from SIU in Carbondale, Allison Joseph is with us. She's an associate professor of English. All of them, Allison's just about to publish What Once You Loved. Gail has just published a new collection of poems called Where the Time Goes. Gail, David, Allison, welcome to the 21st. Thanks so much for being with me, all of you.
Thanks for having us.
My pleasure.
Allison, let's start with you, because you're not an Illinois native, but I'm so curious to hear about how moving to Illinois impacted your perspective. And you're also kind of known as an ambassador for lots of other poets throughout the state. For people who are not familiar with the poetry scene across Illinois, how would you describe it?
Well, one of my missions has been to help poets who are Chicago-based experience poetry in the rest of the state, because of course Chicago is, it's one of the nation's leading cities, it's one of our leading cities for art and literature and music, and sometimes folks in Chicago don't even know what's going on in Chicago, it's so big. But part of it was being involved with the Illinois Arts Council and going up to grant meetings. I was able to see all the various centers of literary activity in northern, central, and southern Illinois. It's all over the state. So part of my mission has been to get Illinois poets in touch with one another.
How do you do that?
I have a Facebook group.
That sounds great. So you are all communicating in social media. All of you guys all know each other.
Yeah,
David, can I ask you, you grew up in Washington, Illinois.
Right.
How have your experiences growing up in Illinois shaped your work as a poet?
When I was first trying to write, I was at Millikan University as an undergrad, and I didn't think you could write about this place because it seemed like it was
not poetic enough.
Yeah, less literary than other places. And I had a professor who had a class on Illinois poetry, and he probably brought in maybe 8 or 10 different poets, and we read more than that. And I realized that it was about how you looked at this place and how you engaged with it that could make it art. And so I discovered the whole literary tradition of the place, everybody from Gwendolyn Brooks all the way back to Sandburg and forward to contemporary writers, Elise L. Mueller, people like that. And so I realized I could make my art out of this place, and that's kind of become one of the markers for the way that I read and write and teach.
Right. Well, it's such an interesting thing about a place in poetry, and you mentioned Carl Sandburg, and when I lived in Chicago, every time it was foggy, I always thought about the fog coming in on little cat feet. Like, it just was something I always thought when I was driving down Lakeshore Drive. And I wonder, David, when you think about being particularly in central Illinois, you know, I've talked to photographers. I'm thinking of Champaign-based photographer Larry Camphor about the landscape of central Illinois. And he talked to me about how when you have sort of this flat landscape, especially when there are fields, like, he sort of sees that as almost like an ocean in a way. And I wonder, do you think about sort of the landscape and those aesthetic images, and how does that figure into your writing?
It's incredibly important for me because I think you have to learn to look harder on that kind of landscape. It's not necessarily obvious where the frames or where the beauty might be. And it's there. You just have to figure out how to see it. And poetry has helped me do that. Poems by people like John Nopeful and Sandburg and others have sort of shown me the place as being textured and more complex than you think when you just sort of look at it on the surface. And Larry Canfer or Ray Beal or some of those Champagne photographers are good examples of that.
Well, I feel like we can't have a conversation about poetry without reading some poetry, right? And David, I wonder, can you read, I know this is, there's a poem that you wrote, Like Trees Planted by Streams of Water, from your work, A Liturgy for Stones. Would you mind reading that for us?
Sure. Like trees planted by streams of water. On this small bluff, lives hang like leaves. A psalm trickles and surges in roiling eddies and worried curves. The Illinois could erode the banks. All the new and old oaks could tumble into a templed dam, but roots twist hard, instead beneath the river's silted bed. They fill and feed the farthest leaves that burn until lives fall to the water in flames. The colors catch and wither in human debris. Between a milk carton and one rented ski, a single silverfish breaks the gray-green surface of its world, like a tiny god might puncture the sky.
That's Like Trees Planted by Streams of Water. David Wright, who wrote that, was just reading that for us. That's from one of his two books. That's from A Liturgy for Stones. In studio with me as well, Gail Renee Walden. Gail, your most recent collection of poems that just came out is called Where Time Goes, and there's sort of this theme of procrastination.
Where the Time Goes. I'm surprised you picked that up. I do have a procrastination series.
As many writers have, and many journalists, I think we have a similar vein to you where you don't have a deadline, things don't get done. Why did you choose to write about procrastination?
Well, I wasn't doing anything, and I decided I should make that productive in some way, so I started to write about not doing anything. As one of the poems is called, I've Done Very Little Today, and I just followed my day and how little I felt like I had done. And yet, you know, the considerations of the day became more and more. So
I think it's interesting, Gail, your work. We were talking before we went on air about the past work you've done with the Education Justice Project and teaching poetry and writing or memoir writing, whether that's been in the Danville Correctional Center or the Decatur Women's Prison. What is it like when you bring poetry into those settings?
So, first of all, that was the best. I got to teach a whole semester class at Danville, and that was the best teaching experience I've ever had because the students there were so open and willing to learn. And it was through the University of Illinois, so it was a regular college class. I started out doing Shakespeare for 4 weeks and then went into form poetry because I like to use form in teaching because poetry is very emotive, and young teenagers or people locked up in certain ways have a lot of emotion, but not necessarily the tools to get it out.
And so form poetry, can you explain that to us?
So, yeah, I mean, you give people a certain form. So, for example, a sestina has six stanzas, six different words. It's very controlled. And that control can lead to a lot of freedom within the line. So it's a very good way to start out if you haven't written poetry before. It kind of unlocks you. I know Allison actually works more in form than I do. I usually write in free verse, not form, although I use form as exercise sometimes.
Allison, why do you use form a lot more?
So I agree with what Gail says. It's the perverse thing that happens when you set limitations, sometimes things that you never expected to come out find their way out. So, and I'm also the type of person who likes crosswords and puzzles and figuring things out, and many poetic forms have that charm to them, that you're figuring things out as you go.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation about poetry in Illinois. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I'm speaking with three Illinois poets from all across the state. Gail Renee Walden from Urbana, David Wright from Monmouth in Western Illinois, and Allison Joseph from Carbondale in Southern Illinois. It's so interesting, as I'm talking to all three of you, that all of you have taught. Do you think that's sort of part of being a poet these days, that you have to do another profession of teaching? Allison, what do you think?
Most of the poets I have known throughout my life teach in one way or another. They either teach at universities or colleges, or they do short stints at writing conferences or colonies. Poets are always teaching. Even some of the poets I know whose primary profession, someone like Cedale Young, who is a physician, he often teaches at writing workshops, and he's been a mentor through low-residency creative writing programs. So I think there's something about poetry that lends itself to the instructive. I think just the very act of writing a poem is an attempt to share something, to teach somebody else something about your own life.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes there's a lot of criticism of the fact that poetry seems locked in the academy, and I find that to be frustrating, because when I go out and give a reading in a public library or a bookstore or someplace like that, I find that all sorts of folks are attracted to poetry. They just feel that it's a little mystifying. And right. So one of the pleasures of teaching is being able to open up the poem and say, you can experience this however you like. You're not getting a grade for this. Just read it. And that's really a lot of pleasure. And so I like to sort of think of the academy maybe as colleges, universities, as supporting poetry, but I think that all three of us are committed to bringing it into the rest of the world, whether it's the Education Justice Project or whether it's Allison promoting it around the state. It's something that pretty much anyone can have access to. They just don't think of it as sort of on their radar all the time.
Yeah, David, what do you say to people who say things like, I just don't get poetry, or I've never thought about reading poetry, or I'm intimidated by reading a book of poems?
Yeah. Yeah, just put it down and pick up a different poem. Find one that gives you pleasure. Find one that surprises you. You know, we binge watch television. We watch 300 episodes of the same series. Try binge reading some poems and see which one appeals to you. There's no requirement. Enjoy it. Let it have its own pleasures.
As we say that, Gail, I wonder if you could read something from your latest collection. What do you want to read for us?
You know, since Allison said she will read a villanelle, I will go ahead and read something that isn't a villanelle.
Okay.
And it's very short. It's called Healing. It came one day, simple as a cornfield, sprung from summer, burned into ground. We didn't believe it could go anywhere else. Someone chose it for us, said, this time it's yours. It was simple until it wasn't. It was the way the red hawk flew beyond madness into the trees, the way we looked towards the sun as if it belonged.
That's called Healing.
Healing.
That is from Where the Time Goes. It's just out, a new collection of poems from Gail Renee Walden. We're talking about poetry with Gail and David Wright and Allison Joseph. You know, Allison, as we started this conversation, you were talking about so much of when we think about poetry and, frankly, the arts in Illinois, so much focus does go to Chicago because of it is, you know, it is a very established and known both in the U.S. and internationally for their poetry, for their arts, for their theater. You know, I'm thinking of spoken word competitions like Louder Than a Bomb that, you know, draw young people into spoken word. And, you know, even people like Chance the Rapper. Chance started as, you know, doing spoken word poetry. And now he's sort of this huge, you know, international artist. I wonder, Allison, when you think about what do you want people to know about the arts or about the poetry scenes in different towns outside of Chicago?
That's a really complex and difficult question, but basically what I want folks around the state to know is that we have this tremendous literary heritage, and every place I go in Illinois, there are people who are poets, who are writers. There are writers' conferences all over the state. One occasion, I was in Chicago, and I was doing a reading at Women Made Gallery, and I was reading alongside another poet, another Allison Funk, who teaches at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. And I was explaining to my Chicago friends about the poets and the poetry that was happening in southern Illinois, particularly the Illinois side of St. Louis. So we have all these different small cities and larger cities, and there's a lot that goes on in the quad cities through the Midwest Writing Center. And I just want people to acknowledge that it's there. And one of my dreams, one of my pipe dreams, is to have a statewide poetry or a statewide literature conference just to acknowledge that there's so much talent in the state.
Yeah. So for people who are listening who think, I want to find out more about this, I want to go to poetry readings that happen, what are good resources for them? Where do you think the best place for them to start is? Whether they're in Bloomington or Peoria or Springfield or Carbondale, where do you think is a good place for them to go, Allison?
For them to get information about upcoming events, well, I mentioned my Facebook group, and it's on Facebook. It's called Illinois Poets and Prose Writers. And I've been using it to promote events in my part of the state, but what's lovely about it is that anyone can join and post things about what they're doing. So we have people posting stuff that's happening in Quad Cities and places that are, you know, sort of overlooked. And
well, Facebook, that's a great resource. We'll share that. You know, Allison, everyone else has read poetry, but you, would you like to read a selection for us from What Once You Loved? I know that's coming out soon.
It is coming out soon. I have the proof pages in my lap. So that's always an exciting stage.
Yeah, congratulations.
And you're looking at it and trying to find the errors before it goes to print. So this is a poem called Headline News. I actually wrote it quite a bit of time ago, but it's really relevant now. Headline News. So what if I am weeping through the news, this daily litany of wreck and pain? A woman has the right to feel the blues in every variation, all its hues. No need to force a smile to entertain. So what if I am weeping through the news? Don't call me oversensitive when clues all point us to a world that's less humane. A woman has the right to feel the blues, to sing about how much she's apt to lose when melody is the only art that's sane. So what if I am weeping through the news, if I am feeling battered, broken, bruised, too tired to get out of bed again? A woman has the right to feel the blues, to mourn until her depth of tears is used and she can rise again, no strain. So what if I am weeping through the news? A woman has a right to feel her blues.
That's from What Once You Loved. That's out, coming out soon, from Allison Joseph. And Allison, thanks so much for sharing that with me. Can I ask you one question just about that?
Sure.
You know, I think that it's very interesting. Natasha Trethewey was here recently at the University of Illinois campus. She's a former poet laureate. I wonder, you know, as we think about poetry, and I had a very interesting conversation with her about the fact that her work is very much about bringing stories that are perhaps hidden or forgotten, her, whether that's her poetry about Black Union soldiers or post-Hurricane Katrina, people who have lived through that. And it was just an interesting conversation. What kind of stuck with me was that she said, you know, there are things that we could talk about that are really difficult that we can't say to people. But if we say it in poetry, that's a way to really broach that. And I wonder, especially as we think about this climate of division and having difficult conversations that maybe I think people just don't even have stopped listening to each other. I guess I thought I'd just ask all of you how you think poetry can play a role in bridging conversations that maybe might be difficult to have otherwise. Can I ask Gail for you to answer that?
It's a good question. And the overtly political, I don't think, for me, doesn't work in poetry because it's dogma doesn't work in poetry for me. And I don't find myself writing at the layer of top layer any kind of issue. But one thing I do notice is that I do discuss religion in poetry that in ways that are hidden and that I don't discuss normally out in the world.
Interesting. Okay.
I think David might do the same thing.
David, do you do that as well?
I do. I think there's a way that poetry does two things. One, it can slow us down because every image, every sound, every word matters a lot. And so you can't read poetry quickly. When I assign my students a whole book of poems, they're like, oh, this is only 50, 60 pages, and then it takes them all week to read it, you know. So it slows us down. We pay a certain kind of attention to what's there. And I think that poetry also is full of surprise or turns, and turns of phrase or turns of the poem, and that can show us things that are difficult to say directly, so we kind of refract what we're saying. We say one thing through another thing, and that seems a little bit less terrifying, perhaps, than saying straight up, you know, Gail's poem about healing refracts us with pain through the cornfields, and it's interesting that poetry does that, and I think it's what you're talking about, or what Trethewey was talking about, that poetry can allow us to say things we can't say straight on otherwise.
Allison, what do you think about that, especially as I'm thinking about, you know, as both you and David have talked particularly about interacting with your students? I wonder your thoughts.
Well, last year I taught a course for our graduate students in the SIUC MFA program all about poets who had been either murdered or forced into exile, or we talked about poets whose very art, because they've been under repressive governments, was very threatened. And at the beginning of this, it was interesting, we were doing this in a climate of knowing what might happen. And it was interesting, all the poets who are in their 20s and 30s, they're MFA students, they're young, they all said, no, we're not political poets. But interestingly enough, after the election, what were they all doing? Organizing protests and marches and readings against the status quo, the current status quo. So it's interesting how things can change and how we define ourselves as apolitical or not political in our writing and in our art, depending on the circumstances. So I never exclude anything from my own poetry. If I want to make a political comment, I do it. I'm a Black person. I'm not going to shy away from that. So I do not see anything as off limits for poetic potential. One of the ways that poets can get to things, to uncomfortable truths, is through humor. And I do that a lot in poems. Not in the poem I read.
But right.
A lot, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes you disarm people with humor before you get them to the point that you want them to hear.
Gail, do you want to add something?
Yeah, I agree with what Allison was saying, because I do think that poetry can be a deeply subversive form. And when I'm talking about, I don't think the top layer is political like editorial. That doesn't work for me. Although I wouldn't go against it across the board, because there's many people that it does work for. But I just think that even when you're not writing about politics, that there is something, can be something subversive, and poetry can move things in political ways without being overtly political.
Interesting. Well,
I think it sticks with you too. I mean, I think I had a student come to my office and they memorized a poem and were reciting it for me, and then I saw them a week or two later and they still had that line in their head, you know. And I think that's a subversive thing too, to get your language inside somebody else in a way that troubles them or challenges them or invites them. That's a really wonderful thing about poems.
Right, yeah. So thank you so much. Thanks, all of you, for having this conversation, for helping us find resources for poetry all across the state, the thriving scene, as Allison has pointed out to us. I want to thank Allison Joseph joining us from Carbondale, from Southern Illinois University, where she teaches English. Look out for What Once You Loved. That'll be out soon. I want to thank also Gail Renee Walden in studio with me here in Urbana, Her new collection of poems is called Where the Time Goes. That's just out. And thanks also to David Wright joining us from Western Illinois. We really are all over the state, where he teaches creative writing and American literature at Monmouth College. Gail, David, Allison, thanks for being with me. Thanks for helping us celebrate an Illinois version of National Poetry Month.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
That does it for us today. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.